ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director at EAA, one of your hosts across the table.
I'm Chris Henry, the EAA Aviation Museum Manager. So welcome back for another episode. I think we always really enjoy getting to talk to different people. A lot of times we get to talk to folks who are kind of associated with some of our favorite aircraft. And today is a great example of that. I kind of have a secret love affair with the F-8 Crusader. I've always said that was just a really cool airplane. And we're very lucky to have a Marine Corps aviator here with us who flew the F-8, Jim Markle. Jim, thank you for being here so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit about how did you first get interested in flying?
Well, actually, I went to solve my looming draft obligation and discovered that the Marine Corps had a 6-month reserve program where I could go to boot camp, finish, and then in 6 months, and then spent 7.5 years attending weekend meetings. When I told an associate at the college I was going to at the time about that, he said, well, you know, you ought to really look into the aviation program because the Marine Corps has a Marine Aviation Cadet program. It takes about 18 months to go through. And when you finish, you'll get your Navy wings and be designated a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps, commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. So that's what I did.
Oh, that's awesome. So how did you eventually get into the flight training aspect of it?
Well, I went through boot camp, and which I'm glad I did, but it's not an easy experience, as all enlisted Marines will tell you. I was fortunate enough to be the honor man on my platoon, which meant, they've always made a joke out of this a little bit, was that I got a meritorious promotion to PFC, which took my salary from $78 a month to $110 a month. But I really enjoy. I look back on that, and that experience, that training was terrific.
Wow. Can you tell us about maybe some of the aircraft that you flew while you were training?
Yeah, absolutely. After I finished my 6-month obligation as an enlisted Marine, I received orders. If I recall correctly, it arrived on a Thursday to report to Pensacola by the following Monday, which I did do. And that kicked off 16 weeks of the School of Preflight, which is done at Mainside Naval Air Station, Pensacola. And it was, to kind of describe it, there were various phases, but basically physical training in the morning and academics in the afternoon. And it was a very intense program. I've got a lot of respect for the Navy's flight training. They really teach you everything you need to know, and they make sure that you perform. The washout rate is fairly high because they don't accept. They'll give you a second chance if you don't pass the test, but that's it.
Wow.
And I had a friend of mine from high school who went through. He is a Navy F-18 pilot now, but when he was going through primary training, I was very surprised by just how long you spend before they even let you touch an airplane. It's
Oh, it was 4 months. Wow. 4 months, and then I went to Softley Field, and he may have also, and it flew the T-34 was the first airplane, and that's built by Beechcraft. And the basic airframe is very, very similar to a Beech Bonanza civil airplane, but instead of a four-place cabin, it's got two tandem seats in a trainer configuration.
Yeah, he was actually in one of the last classes in the T-34 Charlie before they switched to the T-6, and it seemed like a lot of the training was just how to get out of the darn thing or how to handle emergency procedures, because in the T-6, most of the emergency procedures just end with pull the handle, you know.
Yeah.
Wow. So at what point, did you transition to fighters?
Well, first was a T-34. Then I went on to, primary training, which was in the T-28, a North American product with a 1400 horsepower, radial engine. And that also, gave me my first opportunity to qualify on an aircraft carrier. And I landed on the USS Antietam. you might find it in an old history book, but it was one of the original aircraft carriers. It had been converted, though, to have an angled deck. I look back at that. I believe in my logbook I had about 140 hours, and they qualified me to land on an aircraft carrier. And people say, well, how do you do that? And the Navy's philosophy was you just do a lot of repetitions of the things that are important. And the things that are important on a carrier landing are lineup, airspeed, and angle of attack. And I went through that program. And also, piston airplanes require a little bit different technique in carrier landings. The landing signal officer, known as the LSO, who stands at the end of the back of the ship, he actually directs you with paddles. And as a matter of fact, the call sign for landing signal officers is, even to this day, is paddles. And that's the guy you see in the old movies on the back of the boat. And with a piston-powered airplane, when you're in the right position, they actually give you a cut. So you cut the power and land, and hopefully the tail hook grabs a wire. The target wire is always the three wire. And I was able to get my six traps for my initial carrier qualification, but I had under 200 hours total flight time, and I think that speaks to the degree of training that the Navy prepares you for.
Wow. What's that like when that hook catches that wire? That's got to be kind of a brunt stop, right?
Well, it is, and I remember my instructor at Whiting Field when I was first qualifying in the T-28, he said, whatever you do, he said, you got to do your checklist on the downwind and, you know, make sure the hook's down and the gear's down and flaps and so forth. But he said, also make sure that you lock your shoulder harness. Otherwise, you'll go through the rest of your life with the imprint of a gun sight on your forehead.
Wow.
And the I know that today they do the Navy and the Marines train together. Was it the same back then as well? So you're training with Navy pilots?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I went through most of my advanced training, including jets, with a couple of naval aviation cadets, Navy guys. Actually, fairly well-known Navy guys. One of them was Phil Vampatella, who later downed a MiG flying off of the Hancock. In Vietnam. And rather interesting story. He was on a mission over downtown Hanoi, and his airplane was shot up pretty badly. And most of the fuel in the Crusader was carried in the wings. And because the wings had been punctured, the fuel was leaking out. So he thought it would be better to burn the fuel than to let it leak out. So he lit the afterburner, was going at maximum speed to get back what we called feet wet, in other words, back out over the Gulf of Tonkin so that he could recover on the carrier. As he was doing that, he noticed a MiG was trailing him and in a pretty good firing position, pretty close in. But the Crusader was much faster and was starting to pull away. And as they neared the coastline, Phil looked in his we had rear view mirrors in the Crusader, by the way, that was on the canopy bow so that you could see behind you. And he looked in the mirror, and the MiG was turning toward Red China. So he was leaving the pursuit and was breaking off. So Phil, not to be outdone, even though he's running out of gas because it's all leaking out of the wings, he lights the burner and makes a hard left turn and shoots the MiG down. He then gets on guard frequency, which is the frequency that's broadcast to all aircraft, screaming for a tanker. And unfortunately, they had an alpha strike going on, so all the tankers were busy. But a guy in an A4 who had a buddy store, and that's a centerline fuel tank with a hose and a drogue on it, so the A4 could become a refueler. And he called him on the guard frequency and said, Crusader, I haven't got much, but I'll give you half of what I've got. So they made arrangements to rendezvous as close to the carrier as they could. This is the Hancock. And so Phil found him, plugged in, took just a little bit of fuel, trapped on the Hancock, and it flamed up.
Wow.
He was awarded the Navy Cross for that mission.
Wow.
Never turn your back on a crusader, I guess.
No, that's right. But Phil is a very nice guy, and I've seen him at a couple of F-8 reunions. He lives in the New York area. Very nice guy.
Wow.
And, of course, everyone has a nickname, and Phil's, by his Navy friends, was the Skinny Guinea. So very, very nice guy, and happy to report that he's still around.
Oh, that is awesome. What an amazing story. You know, a question I always like to ask folks when they've associated with a certain aircraft was, what was your first impression the first time you walked up to an F-8?
I thought, boy, this guy is long. And how do you get up there? Because the side of the cockpit was probably 14 feet or so off the deck. And you may know this, but aircraft carrier skippers, commanding officers, don't like a lot of ladders laying around on the deck because they're a hazard from jet blasts and everything and personnel. So the Crusader had a series of handholds and footholds built into the side so that you could climb aboard without an external ladder. I need to tell you a story. When I, my first flight in a Crusader, that's always a solo, by the way. So here I am, a brave newly minted aviator. They call you a nugget because you have wings of gold, but they haven't quite been hammered into shape as yet. And you have about 300 hours total flight time. And since they had no two-seat versions, the instructor pilot would be in a separate Crusader and follow you, and he could help you out on the microphone if you had any problems. That first flight, you made it in basic engine. In other words, no afterburner, because one of the big tests of a new pilot was things are happening pretty fast. I mean, there's a lot of pretty high-powered airplane, and you had to get the gear up and the wing down before 220 knots were the limiting speeds. The fellow that was giving me a briefing on this flight was an excellent guy and an excellent pilot by the name of Steve Folger. And he told me during the briefing, he said, now, make sure that you start off on the right foot, which is, by the way, the left foot. But when you climb, he said, because if you get up to the canopy and you're ready to step on board inside and the pointy end is behind you, climb down and start over. So I followed his advice. But if you always start on the left foot, you would end up with your left foot on the last step, and then you can step into the cockpit. That was my first impression. There was a lot going on, and as you may know, those airplanes didn't have a battery. So you were reliant on ground support units to get the engine started so you could bring a generator online and power everything up. And that's exactly what we did, and I remember that first flight well, even just in basic engine. As I recall, the basic engine had about 16,000 pounds of thrust, and then you increased that by 50% if you went into afterburner. So 24,000 pounds of thrust in afterburner, which my squadron mates would say that then with a lightly loaded Crusader, which might be around 22,000 pounds, you had more thrust than you had weight, so you were going ballistic.
Wow. So
that's the expression that they use. And I remember that even though being in basic engine, that 220-knot limit for the landing gear and the wing came up pretty fast. Got it all done, and I had two flights like that. But the third flight, was allowed to use the afterburner. By that time, I had rehearsed it over and over in my mind and had it down. And one thing that was something never leaves you is the F-8 was probably the last fighter with what they call a hard light on the afterburner. If you look at pictures of today's jets and it shows the tailpipe when the afterburner is being lit, you see it come in stages. That wasn't true of the Crusader. They had the engine at maximum RPM. You lit the afterburner, it poured raw fuel into the tailpipe and ignited it. So basically you had a rocket boost to an already powerful engine. And Anyway, that 220 knots came up pretty quick, but I got it all done. Now, on the third flight, the third familiarization flight, this was back in the day when aircraft manufacturers invested their own money in developing these airplanes. And so they used they used every possible marketing gimmick they could. And one of the things that Chance Vought wanted to do was to make sure the Crusader was the first production airplane that could sustain 1,000 miles an hour in level flight. Now, many airplanes, experimental airplanes, had done it before, but the Crusader was the first production airplane that could. And so things are happening fairly fast. I mean, after all, I had all 350 hours. I must know what I was doing. But anyway, I dearly love the machine. I can still, it's been over 50 years since I last flew an F-8, and I can still feel that concussion and that acceleration of lighting that afterburner. It was quite an experience. But anyway, that third flight, we would go out past Catalina Island, head toward Mexico, and the Pacific Missile Range up in Oxnard could see you on radar. And you'd let the airplane run out, and Pacific Missile Range would clock you on radar. And I remember the guy calling and saying, "We've got you at 1,036 miles an hour." And so I wrote that down on my kneeboard, finished the flight. When I came back, the Vought tech rep was on the ramp and presented me with a 1,000-mile-an-hour club pin. And they promoted that very heavily, a 1,000-mile-an-hour club, because the first production airplane to be able to sustain that speed. So it was quite a performer, and it was a beautifully handling airplane. It had probably the best balance feel between pitch and roll of any airplane I've ever flown. Really a superb job. And it was all hydraulically powered. There was no mechanical linkage to the flight controls.
So one of the, probably if anybody has ever seen a Crusader, the thing that they are probably most curious about is the variable incidence wing.
Yes.
Kind of looks like a break action shotgun opening up, you know.
It does.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and why that is?
Yes, absolutely. They developed the airplane with the idea of it would cruise in excess of 1,000 miles an hour. So it would be a real air superiority interceptor. They found that to do that with the design they had for the airframe, that the nose gear would probably have to be about 15 feet long. And of course, that takes a pretty good beating on a carrier landing, so you really don't want that much metal sticking out. So Vought engineers, and if you're a historian and remember the Chance Vought F4U, the Corsair.
Sure.
It had a gull wing. And the reason for that was that to get it to perform, it was swinging a 14-foot prop. And the concern was always about the tip of the prop hitting the deck on a carrier landing. And so to get it up high enough off the deck to do that, they would have required some extremely long landing gear. So they bent the wing inward, the gull wing feature, and put the landing gear at the lowest point of those gull wings so that the airplane could have a relatively conventional length landing gear but still keep the prop from hitting the deck. Well, they effectively did that with the Crusader. They said, well, we have to have the airplane that cocked up to get it to slow enough to land on a carrier. The only way we can do it and sustain the abuse that a carrier landing imposes on an airframe would be to make it a variable incidence wing, because it's the wing that's doing the flying. So get the wing cocked up. And what that would do is, I have a picture of showing the actuator for that wing, and it's a rod a little less than an inch in diameter. And that's what is holding the front end of that wing on when it's in the raised position. But it always works, so I never question it. But when it would, to raise the wing, you would first unlock it, and there was a handle on the right side. And when you pulled that handle back, these are all hydraulically actuated. The entire leading edge would droop down pretty dramatically. The wing would raise, and the ailerons and the flaps would droop. So you had a lot of camber in the wing, both front end and back edge. And I have a video of that operating that I'll show you a little bit later today.
So when you actuated the wing, obviously, so the wing's pulling back. So to you in the cockpit's essentially dropping, right?
That's correct, because the wing's doing the flying, so you're getting down so the pilot can see the deck. Yeah.
So from your perspective, you're still flying the air. You're still flying the attitude that you're seeing. So you're basically trimming that out as it's coming down.
That's correct.
Okay.
There is a little bit of a balloon when the wing goes all the way up because of all the extra high lift devices that are coming down. Mm-hmm. The airplane has a tendency to balloon, but. No, you just have a better view of what's in front of you.
Yeah, makes sense.
So can you tell us, a little bit before we deploy, because I know you get deployed to Vietnam, which we're going to talk about. I believe you met a special woman stateside first, correct? She's here with us.
Yes, a very special woman. And for some unknown reason, I am the luckiest guy in the world. She's stuck with me all these years, and we're going to celebrate 56 years of marriage this July.
Wow. And I almost feel like we should do one of these with her, too. She was a TWA flight attendant.
She was. And I knew that this was true love, not just a passing fancy. I got back from Vietnam. We were married about 6 months later. And we drove from Henderson, Nevada, where her folks lived, and we were married, to Brunswick, Georgia, where I was an instructor at the Naval Air Station Glencoe. And we got back. And I had taken some leave for the wedding and the drive back. And I said, you know, darling, I've got to go night fly on Tuesday because I'm not current with my night landings, and we night flew on every Tuesday. So we went out to night fly, and as I'm taxiing out, I see our car. This was the days before extreme security. And there's Bev parked next to the end of the runway. Now, if you've ever seen a Crusader at night light its afterburner, it throws a flame about 40 feet long. So I thought, if this lady is coming out just to watch a Crusader take off, she must really have an appreciation for this lifestyle. So,
well, that's fantastic, and congratulations to you both, too.
Thank you for
that achievement. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
So shortly after this, you do deploy, after meeting Bev, you do deploy to Vietnam.
After meeting her, I did, yeah. As a matter of fact, I met her on a cross-country to Nellis Air Force Base. By this time, her folks had moved to Henderson, Nevada, just outside of Las Vegas, and she moved with them. And it's actually kind of a funny story. It was a blind date. The assistant ops officer who kept track of all of our qualifications and so forth mentioned to me one day, he said, you know, my wife has a cousin, and she lives near Las Vegas, and I see you spending a lot of Friday nights there. And I said, yes, I do. And he said, and she has a new car and everything. And sure enough, she did have it. She had a new Oldsmobile Cutlass. So in any event, I called Bev, and we had a very liberal cross-country policy out of El Toro. You couldn't have an airplane. The rules were you couldn't have an airplane until the secure flight operations on Friday, which was 5 o'clock. So being a lot of very clever first lieutenants, we figured out the best places to go on Friday night, where if you could not go supersonic over land because of the sonic boom problem, but you could go 9.8 Mach, which is still pretty fast. And so our favorite stops on Friday night were to go to Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas, or Alameda or Moffett Naval Air Stations up in the San Francisco Bay Area, because at high speed you get there in about 40 minutes. And so, you know, we had our priorities in order, training-wise, so that you could be in the bar by happy hour. And So I flew up to called Bev, and she hesitantly, I think she wondered, where does this guy want a blind date? Anyway, in those days, clubs were a little bit different than they are today. Air Force clubs were especially well-staffed. And you walked in, and there was a maitre d' at a circular desk. And I had called in advance to get Bev through the gate and get her on the base. And they had her name and everything. And so she was showing her ID. And, of course, I had never met her. And I see this very beautiful gal in a basic black dress walk in. And I thought, gee, wouldn't I be lucky if it were my date? And it was. And that started a relationship that's spanned almost 58 years now.
Wow. That's fantastic. Wow. And then it was only a short period of time after you deployed, or after that you did deploy, right? It was pretty...
I got back from the cross country meeting Bev, and I think kind of a good story. One of the rules of cross country is you had to take a junior guy with you for experience. And so I picked my favorite wingman, a guy by the name of Richard Bloom. And Dick was just a wonderful guy. Sadly, was lost in Vietnam, but he went with me. And I remember briefing for our departure flight. There was a little patch of grass outside of Nellis Air Force Base, base operations. And Dick and I are sitting in the grass, and I'm briefing him on the takeoff. And, you know, saying things like, okay, we're going to hold it down real low, and I'll give you a signal for the gear up and the wing down. We're going to hold it about 50 feet until we get 500 knots. Then we're going to do an enablement to depart going the opposite direction. He looks at me. He looks over at Bev, who's standing by the base ops building, and he said, this must be serious. I said, I think it is. And so we made a... what turned out to be a great formation to take off. But when I got back to El Toro, in my inbox at the squadron were my orders to Vietnam, you know, leaving in 6 weeks. And they were individual orders to a ground unit. You know, one thing, every Marine is basically a rifleman. You know, a lot of other services, guy will go into a squadron from day one and stay there until he retires after 20 years. Not true in the Marine Corps. So I was getting my tour with the grunts, and I say that with all due respect. There, I really learned a lot from that experience. But I went to the air office of the 3rd Marine Amphibious Force, group that put, I think, 40,000 Marines ashore in South Vietnam, the first big troop buildup in late 1965. And I was in an office, and I learned about the principle of RHIP, rank has its privileges. I was in an office run by a bird colonel. We had a lieutenant colonel, a major, and me, a first lieutenant. So when one of the operating infantry outfits had need for an air controller, they came to our office and requested it. I volunteered every time. on those missions. But I enjoyed that experience. Wonderful people, really brave. Matter of fact, to put that in perspective, I can remember one night, very particularly, we'd been walking for about 5 or 6 days in a misnamed place called Happy Valley. And the squad leader was a Lance Corporal. That's an E3. I mean, but he'd been in country for about 6 months. He was very experienced, and he was in charge. I wasn't. He was outranked by a couple of guys in his own squad, but he was in charge. And we had been walking all day, and I was just exhausted. And he said, "Okay, when we get on the reverse side of this hill, we're going to dig a hole and bed down for the night." So we got on the reverse side, and I don't know if you've ever tried camping in a jungle environment, but one of the difficulties is all the foliage there sends out these root networks, thousands of them. It's very difficult to dig through because you got to break through all these small roots to get a hole in the ground. And so I used my entrenching tool, I got it deep enough where I could lay down in this depression that I had dug, and none of my body was above the ground level. And I ate my K rations and fell asleep. That night we were mortared, and I could hear the shrapnel passing over me, but I was below the fragmentation zone, and all because this Lance Corporal insisted, no eating, no go to sleep, dig the hole first, and then you can. And so those guys knew what they did, and they also knew the principles of leadership. So,
wow, that's incredible. So how did you end up flying combat in the F-8?
Well, I started, I wanted to let Headquarters Marine Corps know that the world's greatest fighter pilot was sitting at a desk in a command bunker managing all of the ground forces, Marine ground forces in South Vietnam, northern part of South Vietnam particularly. And it actually worked. After about 7 months, I was transferred to an F-8 squadron. It was at the Da Nang Airport, which is about 12 miles away. And so I spent the balance of my tour in that fighter squadron.
Well, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't go any further mentioning that the what is the saying, when you're out of F-8s, you're out of fighters.
Well, I mentioned that the manufacturers like to to use marketing phrases, and they used an image. You guys are too young, but there was a Schlitz beer commercial of about the mid-60s that featured a sign that said, when you're out of Schlitz, you're out of beer. So Chance Vaught made a poster that said, when you're out of F-8s, you're out of fighters. And they had a picture of a naval aviator with a helmet on and everything with a tear coming out of his eye. And they used that every time you saw him at a convention, that they had that poster up.
So what was what were the main kind of missions you were flying? Were they close air support? Were they air-to-air?
They were largely close air support, although we did fly a lot of called BARCAP, Barrier Combat Air Control, air patrols. But, I mean, because they were fighters. And the version that I flew in the States, it could carry 400 rounds of 20-millimeter cannon, and it could carry four sidewinders, but that was it. There was nothing that could be mounted on the wing. On the E model that I flew in Vietnam, they had hard points on the wing, so we could also perform the role as a bomber. And that was a tough mission. You know, we see today, particularly the Gulf War and so forth, where there's a video picture with a crosshair on it and the bomb goes right in the middle. Well, that's a smart bomb, and that's guided there by a variety of sources. But the earliest probably was that one airplane had a laser designator in it, and it would illuminate the target. And then the firing airplane would send the bomb down the slope of that illumination and get very accurate hits. We didn't have the luxury of that. Ours depended on, this is where I appreciated the fact that I enjoyed physics when I was in school. If in an F-8, you're exactly on glide path, which was typically 45 degrees, and that doesn't sound too steep until you kind of imagine going from the upper edge of this piece of paper down to the lower edge. When you're in an airplane, the horizon's over your head at 45 degrees, so it's a pretty steep dive. So you're right on a 45-degree dive, which you're only doing by estimate. Secondly, you're right on airspeed, and most of the time our release airspeed was 450 knots indicated, pretty fast, over 500 miles an hour. And you had to release, depending on the ordnance, at a fairly high altitude to stay out of the fragmentation pattern of the ordnance you were dropping. As an example, if you had one advantage the Crusader had was with its high wing, it could carry 2,000-pound bombs. They wouldn't fit on an F-4 or an A-4 because they would drag on the ground when they were taxiing. But the F-8 would. But the release altitude was 4,500 feet, so that's pretty high. And if everything, as I say, if everything was going just perfectly, that iron bomb would fall at the predicted rate and hit the target. But it was very difficult to get all those elements correct. And then you had to be pretty good at putting some Kentucky windage in there if there was any wind, because it would, in fact, move the bomb off target. But we got pretty good at it because we had to be. I think those missions were very challenging because typically when a ground unit called for close air support, it was because they were engaged. And engaged in a jungle environment means they may only be 25 yards from the enemy. I mean, you know, you can't see very far in a jungle. So when you got laying ordnance down and you're that close to the friendlies, you really concentrate on doing the job right.
Wow. I can only imagine.
And then, and that was obviously something that was the kind of the specialty of the Marines. And I'm just curious. I know that there's one mission in particular that we want to get to before we end this. But for Marine Corps Aviation, I know that there were land based units that were even to this day are deployed out in the field, and there are carrier based units. How is that assigned? Are there aviators that prefer one or the other and get assigned to those units? Is it random? How is that? How does a typical Marine Corps aviator's career progress?
Well, I'll describe mine and then I'll tell you the differences. I was West Coast based Marine at El Toro, and that way you get to live on Lido Island and drive a Corvette to work every day, which was pretty cool. But we did not deploy on carriers. I was lucky enough to be sent to Landing Signal Officer School down at the Naval Air Station North Island. So I got a little bit more carrier time than the average West Coast based Marine. In that day and age, however, Marine squadrons on the East Coast, typically from Beaufort or Cherry Point, would deploy on Navy carriers for a Mediterranean cruise. We did not do that in the West Coast. And nowadays, if there is a Marine F-18 squadron on, I think, on every deployed ship that's out there.
Okay. Yeah.
So the Marines are getting a lot more carrier work. So I was lucky enough to get more carrier opportunities because I went to that school and I was our squadron LSO.
Interesting. Yeah, just curious about that.
Yeah.
So let me ask it this way. Is there a mission that does stand out over all your missions that you would talk about?
I had a couple. I don't literally talk or write about myself very often. I do tell the story of, which I'll speak to in the lecture this evening, about receiving a Distinguished Flying Cross. It says for heroic achievement in aerial flight. I emphasize this. I am not a hero. I simply was doing what I was trained to do under sometimes very trying circumstances. So that mission stands out. Another one we did, I didn't really realize it until years later when I understood the political situation that we were involved in the Southeast Asia war games, as we call them. We had missions that were somewhat questionable in the way they were conducted. And I'll give you an example. There was one that had kind of the another misname. It's called a night special. And we would take off typically with 8 500-pound bombs. And we would go to a place in Laos called Chepone, Chepone. Chepone was at a juncture of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and there was where a couple of these trails came together, and after it got dark, they would usually overnight there with these supplies. So it was a target-rich environment. It was very, very difficult, though, because, first of all, it's dark, 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning, and the Department of Defense, for some reason, was hung up on getting counts of various things. How many pounds of ordnance? how many drops did you make? How many? So we were prohibited. We'd have 8 bombs on board, but we could only drop one at a time. And we would set up in a racetrack pattern, usually with 4 airplanes. Well, even though those anti-aircraft guns were manually controlled, by the time you're on your 4th run coming from the same heading, you know, they pretty much know where you are. They get pretty accurate with the AAA. So those missions were difficult. And I can say this today, but I would hope that our government in the future would always be honest and forthright and let the military experts figure out what they do best. But I can remember one night at Chapone and coming back just exhausted, landing, and the mess tent. One thing, the Marine Corps always fed you well. So the mess tent was open 24 hours a day. So at 3 a.m., I went to the mess tent, and I asked the guys what he was serving. He says, I don't know, Lieutenant. He said, we got some real nice-looking Vienna sausage. You want me to eat you up again? And I said, sure. So I got a cup of coffee, and the Stars and Stripes had just been delivered. And the headline was, LBJ denies operations in Laos. Well, I mean, this is 2 hours ago. I was there. And I guess I can tell that story now. And God rest his soul, LBJ is not around anymore. But I wonder why they did that. But those missions were quite hazardous. And the only illumination was they would send a Marine C-46, a DC-3, overhead with the rear door open, and they would kick out parachute flares. And these would ignite and descend. And if the guy was really good at getting the flare out the door, it would fall straight down. But more likely, it would come out at an angle, and so therefore, it would illuminate the mountain, and then it would illuminate it. And it was Vertigo City. I had trying to figure out what those were. So those are a couple of missions that I remember very well.
Well, and I can't wait to hear more tonight. I know we're running out of time here.
Sure.
But thank you for coming all this way, and I appreciate both of you for being here. And I absolutely cannot wait to hear you talk tonight. You're here as part of our speaker series, which you do every month. And I encourage everybody, if you're in the area, come check it out. We also video it, so it'll be available down the road via video as well if you can't make it out here tonight. Again, Jim, thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I think the EAA is near and dear to my heart, and I'm just very pleased to be here in person, and particularly to have Bev with me.
Absolutely. You're a new lifetime member as of today. So,
that's right.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely. Well, again, thanks, Chris, for the pre-production work that went into this episode and every other episode, and of course, our work with the speaker series, bringing in really, really amazing guests almost every month here, with a couple exceptions, you know, the Big Air Show in July and all that. Thanks, Rob, for running our board as always, and all the folks that are involved with the program. And again, thank you, Jim, for coming to EAA, for sharing your story, and of course for your service.
My pleasure. And thank you.
Thank you. And we'll see you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.